May it please the court. Mr. McElbring filed a transfer application in this case, primarily arguing that the pleadings in the amended motion were deficient. Mr. Emmett Queener, before he retired, filed a transfer application in this case, arguing that Mr. Watson had been abandoned by PCR counsel due to lack of communication. Unfortunately, under my review of the record, I do not believe it is necessary for this court to reach either claim. And I'd like to start with point one of the brief. I believe, under my review of the record, that PCR counsel abandoned Mr. Watson due to an untimely filing of the amended motion. If you look at the dates in question, PCR counsel entered an appearance on March 20th, 2013. This would set the initial 60-day deadline at May 20th, and if a 30-day extension had been requested, to June 18th. Now, PCR counsel filed a motion, and it's a motion for leave to file an amended answer, and she filed that on April 12th, so before the 60-day deadline, and she requested a period of 45 days from the date of filing within which to file an amended petition. Now, there's no date requested on the motion, and the motion court simply granted this request. And the question is, what does that phrase 45 days from the date of filing mean? I think it can either mean the date of the filing of that motion or the date of filing an entry of appearance. I'm not sure, but assuming the later of those, she filed it. So the 45th day would have been Tuesday, May 28th, due to the Memorial Day holiday, and the amended motion was filed on May 30th, 2013. So this was longer than that 45 days that she requested. There was no indication by the motion court that it had granted a 30-day extension. Instead, the motion simply said granted. So I think under this court's case law, this court cannot assume that the motion court had granted a longer extension than was requested.
Mr. Buffalo, I know you know opposing counsel says you must, it's only logical to interpret it to mean 45 days from the date that it otherwise would have been due, and you disagree with that.
I disagree for two reasons. The first reason is it's not customary to file a 45-day extension. You cannot do that under the rules. The second is that it was filed so closely to that 45-day deadline. It was filed, I believe, 48 days after the filing, so 3 days beyond that 45. So it's, I believe motion counsel believed she could get it done within that 45 days, and that's what she asked for, and she failed to do it. And 2915G allows the court to extend the time for filing the amended motion for one additional period, not to exceed 30 days. So it's even unclear that she could have requested a second extension of 3 or 4 days. Under Moore v. State, this is a seminal case that kicked off looking closely at the record to see if the amended motion was filed. This court held that the amended motion was untimely, and that was because no extension request had been sought. However, it was filed within 90 days of counsel entering an appearance, and instead of assuming that the motion court had somehow granted a 30-day extension off the record, this court looked to the record to see what was there. I think on this record, the same result is warranted. Opposing counsel argues that the abandonment doctrine should not even apply to this case because counsel was notified rather than appointed. Opposing counsel foresaw the result in the Gittemeyer case released a couple weeks ago. And in that case, this court held that retained counsel, or at least the abandonment doctrine, did not apply to retained counsel. So the question is, does it apply to when there's a notification rather than an appointment? And I think under the Creighton decision, it does apply. First, 2915E says that the court shall cause counsel to be appointed for the movement. So that phrase, to be appointed. And this court went on to explain in Creighton the requirement that the motion court shall cause counsel to be appointed neither prohibits the motion court from providing a notification nor compels the conclusion that a notification must be deemed an appointment. So this court is treating a notification like an appointment in Creighton. And this court went on to state that 2915E provides only that at some point the court must ensure counsel is appointed to represent an indigent movement. And that's what happened in this case. This was not retained counsel. This was a special assistant public defender who entered an appearance on behalf of the public defender's office. In point two, so assuming it's necessary to go on to the remaining points, in point two, Mr. Watson raised in his brief that PCR counsel abandoned him by first failing to communicate with him before filing an amended motion, and then changing a claim within the pro se motion. And we have argued on appeal that that constitutes abandonment due to that lack of communication without contacting the client. I don't believe that would be tolerated in any other setting. I admit the prior case law, for instance, in State v. Bradley, this court held on its face, the motion filed by counsel is clearly a nullity. Nowhere did movement sign or verify it, nor does it state facts sufficient to warrant post-conviction relief. That is a tough standard to meet. I believe that this would require this court to extend abandonment, but I do not believe that is asking too much to require attorneys to communicate with clients before changing claims from the pro se motion to the
amendment. We have held, though, that those types of claims are virtually ineffective assistance of post-conviction counsel rather than abandonment. Isn't that what the case law is pretty clear?
The case law is pretty clear on that, Your Honor.
If in fact, the court determines that your client, Mr. Watson, has been abandoned, the effect of that generally is when it's remanded to the motion court, then counsel, it kind of starts over, as opposed to the amended motion that was filed, then proceedings go forward on it. Instead, a new amended motion would be filed by counsel.
Yes, Your Honor. That would be the difference between points one and point two. In point one, the remedy is to accept the amended motion as long as it's not the client's fault. In point two, the remedy is to allow different PCR counsel to file.
Well, we don't accept the amended motion, is my understanding from the case law, because it is untimely if one is abandoned. Then I thought the process started over, so a new amended motion could be filed.
So
you have to get counsel appointed. If you've been abandoned, you have no counsel. You can't count a motion filed by counsel to abandon you.
I agree with that result. I would encourage this court to adopt that result. I don't believe that follows Moore v. State. In Moore v. State, this court determined that the remedy was to accept the amended motion out of time. I believe, if I'm wrong, I would be happy to be wrong. I believe that a good result would be to allow a different counsel to file an amended motion. I don't believe that's what the case law requires.
I think there's prior case law that does have that result.
And I would advocate for that result. I believe that if a client has been abandoned, you can't trust the amended motion that is filed.
Well, it's not whether you can trust it or not. It didn't count. It wasn't filed timely. It's nothing. We've said an untimely motion doesn't count, so there is no amended motion filed.
I would agree with that result, Your Honor.
Can you address the third issue, and in particular, whether you adequately pled the requirements for relief under the third claim?
Yes, Your Honor. So the performance aspect, I don't think there's any question that it was adequately pled. And the question is the prejudice aspect. And here in 6A, 6B, and 6C, the basic language is Mr. Watson would have accepted the plea bargain and been sentenced to 10 years of incarceration instead of 18. And we know from Missouri v. Fry and from Blaffler that the movement is required to prove three things in this situation where they say they would have accepted a plea had they not received ineffective assistance. They must show first that they would have accepted a plea, second, that the prosecutor would not have withdrawn that plea, and third, that the court would have accepted that plea. And obviously those are not clearly laid out within the amended motion. So the question is, that line, He would have accepted the plea bargain and been sentenced to 10 years of incarceration instead of 18. Is that sufficient? And I believe this question is answered by this court's opinion in Wilkes v. State. In Wilkes v. State, this court held that although the movement had failed to expressly allege that a witness was available to testify, he was saying that his attorney was ineffective for not calling a witness. So it didn't say that in the amended motion. The other allegation in the motion contained a necessary implication that the witness was available to testify.
This because court, otherwise you couldn't say you would have been sentenced to that unless the court had accepted it and unless the prosecutor had not withdrawn it.
Yes, Your Honor. And the rule that this court announced in Wilkes was, thus a movement may successfully plead a claim for relief under Rule 2915 by providing the motion court with allegations sufficient to allow the motion court to meaningfully apply the Strickland standard and decide whether relief is warranted. So the question is, do the pleadings in this case allow the motion court to meaningfully apply the Strickland standard? So saying he would have accepted the plea bargain and been sentenced to 10 years of incarceration instead of 18, I believe, allows the motion court to meaningfully apply the Strickland standard. Without the "and" part of the clause, I believe it wouldn't. Had it merely said he would have accepted the plea bargain, I think it would be deficient. But saying "and been sentenced to 10 years of incarceration" implies the prosecutor would not have taken back the deal. It implies the court would have accepted the deal. And these are factual allegations that Mr. Watson can prove at an evidentiary hearing. My remaining 20 seconds, I just need to correct something. In the initial brief, Mr. Queener was relying on statements of trial counsel at the sentencing hearing, where it was alleged that that trial counsel admitted he didn't understand the elements of robbery. I agree with Mr. McElbrain in the Eastern District that that's taken out of context. So I'm not relying on that. I'm relying on, in fact, just the notion that taking the claim in the amended motion is true. I don't believe it's necessary to rely on the comments at sentencing. Thank you.
May it please the court. A couple of points as to the first two points. On the issue of abandonment, assuming that abandonment applies, in Creighton, this court held that abandonment applies, the doctrine of abandonment only applies to appointed counsel, based on the language of the rule, which refers to appointed counsel. This counsel was not appointed under this court's holding in Gittemeyer, the court held that it only applied to appointed counsel.
The distinction that's made has been retained counsel. Here, it clearly was the public defender.
Well, my reading of the Gittemeyer decision is that the rule said appointed counsel, and that the requirements of the rule put those obligations upon appointed counsel, because that's the language in Rule 2915E.
Although this circumstance was not before the court, and
that's
so
correct.
The ruling's limited to the issue of retained counsel. I understand the terminology, but
sure.
Clearly the purpose, even acknowledged by Gettemeyer, would be it would apply when an indigent individual has a public defender representative.
Certainly, Your Honor. That's one of the reasons for the abandonment doctrine, is to help indigent litigants who are incarcerated, who are inmates, and don't have the same access to the system that somebody else might have.
Mr. McElpren, if we took your argument to the extreme that you're saying, and so say counsel was not appointed at that time, then counsel's still not been appointed and the time hadn't begun to run to file a motion.
Actually, I think the time did start to run, because there are two triggering events that are mm-hmm. under the rule. One is the appointment of counsel. The other is entry of an appearance by counsel who's not appointed. And that
and
occurred
when did,
in this
when
case.
Did counsel enter appearance?
On March 20th.
And is that the date that Mr. Buffalo used?
Mm-hmm. That, pardon me?
Is that, if that date were used, when would the, isn't that the date that was used?
If that
Mr.
is the
Buffalo?
Date that's used to calculate, and I believe it should be the date that's mm-hmm. used, then the amended motion would have been due without extension on May 20th. Then comes the extension request, or motion, requesting a period of 45 days, based on however the court wants to view that order.
It was odd. We all agree, whatever it was odd.
Yeah, I think the language is awkward, and I think that it results in an ambiguous order by the motion court, and I think that this court, as a matter of law, should
construe it. But Mr. Buffalo does, I mean, he's right when you look at it. It says motion to file it on that date in 45 days, and they say motion granted. Nobody says a 30-day extension. We're really particular and tight on extensions. You have to ask for them, and you don't get the time unless you ask for it. So why would this be different? And we say, oh, well, we'll treat it like you wanted, even though they asked for something they're not entitled to under the rule.
Well, I think that they asked for something they're not entitled to under the rule. That's clear, because the rule only allows 30 days, one 30-day extension of time. But I've seen it more than once where counsel comes into the case, asks for more than those allowed, or even asks for multiple extensions that are not allowed. And I've even seen courts purport to grant those. And our courts have looked at that and said, well, you can only grant 30. Anything that was granted beyond that doesn't apply.
Well, I guess what I'm saying is, what if we had a different situation and counsel were coming in and saying, well, I know I said that, but I really meant I wanted 30 days from the end of the time I'd otherwise have, and I filed it timely under that. And I could see the state coming in and saying, no, you just asked for 45 days from the date that you filed the motion, and we're not going to give you any slack because we're...
Right, and if that were brought up in the motion court, and if it were litigated, and we had additional record, that might reveal what had happened. We don't have that here. We have just the order saying
motion granted.
So even assuming that order was valid,
yes,
and according to Mr. Buffalo, it was due then on the 30th. Excuse me, it was due on the 28th, but not filed to the 30th. Do you agree it was filed out of time?
If the court concludes that he was asking for 45 days from the date that the motion was filed, rather than an extension of time of the actual deadline, then yeah, it would be it would extend it out to the 28th, and this amended motion was 2 days out of time.
But is there any scenario that you can come up with that you would say that it was filed within time?
Yes, if the court granted him 30 days from the actual deadline of the amended motion. You know, in normal practice, at least that's the way I see it, it's customary to ask for an extension of the deadline, the actual deadline, and I would imagine that the parties thought they were asking for an extension of the deadline.
But they said from filing.
Well, but they didn't specify from what. And, you know, and it says, and the syntax is a little bit weird. And I, you know, it doesn't.
The full language is date of filing within which to file an amended petition.
That's correct.
Couldn't you interpret that to mean 45 days beyond the date that the deadline?
Yes. And that's what I think. It says from the date of filing, but then it has that additional phrase on there. It doesn't say from the date of this filing or from the date of the filing of this motion. It says within, as Judge Powell said, the time for filing the amended petition. And so I think you can reasonably read that as saying, hey, the amended petition is due by a certain time. I want a period of 45 days beyond that. Now, the trial court purports to grant that. But under the rule, it only has authority to grant 30 days. And so
are we informed further by the fact that he only took 8 days further? Didn't take 45 days. Take 30 days from the date it otherwise would have been, or 10 days from the date it otherwise would have been due. So
yeah, she was apparently more efficient than she thought.
Or not.
So it was due on May the 20th, 60 days from March 20th. And you're saying then the 45 days, or even using 30 days, it would have been due at the earliest June 19th.
Yes, June 19th, and it was ultimately filed on May 30th, about 20 days before the deadline that I calculate, if the court grants 30 days. Now, I'll leave that to the court. It's a question of law for the court to construe what is at least an ambiguous order in this case. Based on the circumstances, the intentions of the party, and the intentions of the motion court, this court can construe that. If the court construes that it was only granting an 8-day extension of time, well, then, in fact, the amended motion filed on the 30th of May was out of time. And it raises the idea of abandonment, which, as I've already indicated, if it wasn't appointed counsel, the state's position under Gittemeyer is that abandonment doesn't apply. But assuming abandonment does apply, the question was raised, well, what's the...
You're saying abandonment does not apply to a public defender who entered their appearance?
So long as
they have
no
authority to do that unless they get treated as appointed by the court. They can't just voluntarily enter an appearance in any case.
Well, they've been doing it. And this case is certainly one where they did it. And if you look at the Creighton case, there was no appointment in that case, but it was a public defender who had entered. Now...
Well, I'm not saying they can't enter their appearance. Of course they can and do. I'm saying that we treat it as appointed counsel. The courts accept them. They can only do so as a public defender.
But the court in Creighton did not treat him as appointed counsel. The court said that the notification was not an appointment.
No, the notification is not, but the entry of appearance, as you point out.
But that's still not an appointment.
They can't unless they've been accepted by the court as the representative.
I guess if the court wanted to construe the entry of appearance as an appointment.
Thank you.
The court could. I'm not trying to suggest that the court can't do any number of things. I think the court can construe any number of things that happened in this case one way or the other. But I do want to state what I think the result of those things is. If there was abandonment in this case, the ordinary remedy is to send it back to the court to inquire. Well, whose fault was it that this was late? If it was counsel's fault, then there was abandonment. And what the remedy in that case is to allow the filing of the untimely motion. That's what the court said in Moore, and it goes all the way back to Lulip and Sanders, the two cases that talk about the two general categories of abandonment.
Do you agree there are other cases between Lulip and Sanders and Moore that said the remedy was to have a new counsel and a filing of an amended motion?
Only in cases where no amended motion was filed at all. That's the remedy in cases for the first category of abandonment. When there's no amended motion filed at all, the remedy under, if you look, and go back to Lulip and Sanders, which is where the abandonment doctrine grows out of. If there's no amended motion at all, the remedy is to go back, have new counsel appointed, and to allow time under the rule, as you would normally allow, to file an amended motion. If an amended motion was filed, but it was merely filed late, the remedy has consistently been, since Lulip and Sanders were decided, to send it back for an abandonment inquiry, or the suggested remedy is send it back, and if there was abandonment, then permit the untimely filing and proceed.
And permit if the defendant or the movement objects to that because he or she truly believes that he's been abandoned and not properly represented, wouldn't the trial court have the authority to appoint new counsel?
I don't think they have the authority to appoint new counsel. Because the movement would have already received under the rule what he's entitled to, which is a limited right to counsel to have counsel file an amended motion.
But that counsel abandoned them, that's the one exception where they haven't indeed received what they're entitled to.
But the abandonment we're talking about there is merely failing to meet a particular deadline.
So there's two levels of abandonment?
Yeah, there are two types of abandonment, two categories. One is where you don't file any motion at all. The other is where you file a motion.
So there's real abandonment and just...
No, there's two categories of abandonment. That's what this court said in Barton. One is where there's no motion filed at all, which I would argue, yeah, sure, that's a more egregious type of abandonment. Then there's a second category of abandonment, which is where they just missed the deadline, and where they filed a motion, but they missed the deadline. And in that instance, the remedy has been to permit the untimely filing. Now, a civil litigant in a case might be able to say, you know what, I don't want that attorney that you've given me. I don't want to proceed on their amended motion. I'd rather proceed on my pro se motion. Maybe they could do that. But that doesn't mean that they get to avail themselves of another round under the rule to have counsel appointed. It's a limited right. Now, if they don't like the motion that's filed because they believe it doesn't contain all the claims, or they think that it misstates a claim, well, that's a claim of ineffective assistance of post-conviction counsel. What they're saying in that instance is that counsel did not do a good job in drafting my amended motion. And this court has consistently said, we're not going to expand the abandonment doctrine to take in claims of ineffective assistance of counsel. So if you remand it and give the movement an opportunity to say, I just don't like that one, let's appoint a new one, I think that you've created a new category of abandonment which encompasses myriad claims of ineffective assistance of counsel and opens the door to endless litigation.
You have very limited time. Can you address the merits and whether or not the... language and the trial court would have accepted the plea is sufficient under our law?
Yes. The general requirement is that you allege facts, but the facts not be refuted by the record, and that they be sufficient to grant relief in the case. Under Lafler versus Cooper and Missouri versus Fry, but the one that's more applicable here given the procedural setting is Lafler versus Cooper, the defendant has to allege first that he would have pleaded guilty. Second, that the prosecution would not have withdrawn or canceled the offer. Third, that it would have been accepted by the court and that the plea would have been embodied in the judgment of the court. And fourth, that the ultimate outcome would have been more beneficial either because the defendant was pleading guilty to a lesser offense or because he would receive a shorter sentence than what he received at trial.
Language that was pled, that the trial court would have accepted the plea and that he would have been sentenced according to the plea, that is a pleading of a fact.
It is. Well,
and
he didn't
under those facts, that could not have happened but for the state not withdrawing it and the court finding it should be accepted and imposed.
Yes, except it's also a conclusion. And, you know, the idea that we should imply, particularly under the facts of this case, that the plea would have been accepted by the court and also the state wouldn't have withdrawn its offer, is drawn into question. Well, first of all, I don't think you should imply that. And I think Wilkes, to the extent it says you can imply facts, is contrary to Barnett, which came out later, which says we don't imply facts. But Wilkes was different because it talked about this witness will testify to X. Well, it seems to me to be a pretty small implication to suggest that if the witness will testify, well, they're also available and willing to testify. But here, the implication of facts requires not merely that the court sentence him or that he plead guilty, but also that the state engage in certain conduct. Now, in this case, the problem that the defendant has is not merely that he failed to specifically and expressly allege the second and third points, but that his first allegation that he would have pleaded guilty was refuted by the record. And that calls into question the remaining allegations for prejudice.
Well, doesn't that beg the question? He's alleged that. He's alleged that as a fact and the other facts, and it may well be that he's not able to prove that at an evidentiary hearing for the reasons that you talk about. But on the other hand, maybe that was a call they were willing to make.
Well, except that the first allegation he would have pleaded guilty is expressly refuted by the record because he testified at trial that he was not guilty.
That he didn't, you could question him about that, but he didn't, the fact that he said that at trial does not mean he would not, we all well know it, doesn't mean he wouldn't have pled guilty to both prior to trial.
He swore under oath and testified that he was telling the truth, and he said, I did not commit robbery. I did not commit ACA. Before the
We're
defendant...
Asking, but the question is, what would he have done during the plea time, not what do we think he'd do now or what we can determine.
Right, but we can tell from the record now what he said. And the fact is if we're going to accept the notion that he would have pleaded guilty, we're either accepting the idea that he would be lying at his guilty plea and we're okay with that, or that he was lying at trial. Well, if he was lying at trial, he should allege those facts. And he should tell us why we shouldn't accept on its face his testimony that he was not guilty and that he would now plead guilty.
What about the fact that the court could consider that since he testified that he wasn't guilty, that the court would not have accepted the plea?
I think that's right. I think that there has to be a factual basis. And so the notion that the court would have accepted the plea, as I said, all of the other allegations are drawn into question by the fact that he stood up at trial and said, I was not guilty. He swore under oath that he would tell the truth. And he said, I didn't do it. Now, there are a lot of other facts that could come into play. For instance, an Alford plea. But in those circumstances, the defendant better allege those facts before we unravel the trial proceedings and all the work that was done, and before we undermine his sworn testimony that he was not guilty, we better have good facts.
So we should
alleged.
Change our rule to say you have to plead all the facts that would convince us why we should believe you when you say you would have accepted the plea.
I don't think that's changing the rule, Your Honor. I think that's been the law in Missouri for a long time. You have to plead facts. That if we read those facts and accept them as true, you're entitled to relief.
Thank you, Counselor.
Thank you.
May it please the court. I think it doesn't take a large imagination to know that defendants plead guilty to crimes that they believe they did not admit or that they did not commit, and it happens all the time, that 99% of cases are resolved through a guilty plea, and some of that time the defendant did not actually commit the crime. They just want to get out of jail, or they believe the state has a strong case against them. So I don't believe the fact that he testified at trial means that his claim in the amended motion is contradicted by the record. It is true that it means he would be committing perjury at either trial or at an evidentiary hearing.
Isn't the word refuted as opposed to contradicted?
Refuted, yes, and I'm not sure which one is.
Under your view, that same sort of thing would apply to 24035. Any time you said, "Well, I wouldn't have said that. I would have said something different." What does the language about not refuted by the record mean then? Does it have anything left at all in your view?
Well, I think you have to take it on a case by case basis. And the question was it, and quite frankly, I think. The cases should be encouraged to go to an evidentiary hearing. So I don't believe it should be a stringent requirement. But here, I'm not sure I have a great answer for you. But I don't believe that testifying at trial contradicts or clearly refutes that he would have been willing to plead guilty had he known the proper elements of robbery, forcible robbery. And here, the state has proven at trial, and then Mr. Watson has agreed he would be willing to admit in the amended motion that he committed the acts of forcible robbery. Also found trial of trafficking of drugs. So perjury, when compared to those crimes, that if he perjured himself at trial, it's certainly possible he would have been willing to plead guilty to a crime he didn't actually commit at a guilty plea hearing. So I don't believe it's clearly refuted by the record. But in conclusion, I believe that Mr. Watson was abandoned by a late filing of an amended motion. Judge Powell brought up the full sentence in the motion for leave to file an amended answer. And let me read the full sentence. Come now, Terry Watson, movement herein, and respectfully request a period of 45 days from the date of filing within which to file an amended petition. So the question raised by Judge Powell is, what does the within which to file an amended petition mean? I think it is referring to a future hypothetical amended motion and not referring to the deadline for filing an amended motion. That would have to refer to a deadline for abandonment to have not occurred. I don't believe it does. Thank you very much.